Good evening and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy. Little Atoms is a talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. These ideas find their antithesis in superstition, religious fundamentalism, fanaticism, totalitarianism, censorship and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting, and we're welcoming back an old guest, Francis Wheen, tonight, who Padraig is about to introduce.
Good evening. Francis Wheen is a writer, broadcaster and journalist. He's the author of several books, including a biography of Karl Marx, which won the Isaac Deutscher Prize and is now regarded as one of the definitive sources on the subject. He wrote an award-winning column for The Guardian for several years. He is deputy editor of Private Eye. His collected journalism, Who Hands and Passing Frenzies, won him the George Orwell Prize in 2003. His other books include Tom Dryberg, His Life and Indiscretions, and the set text for Little Atoms listeners, How Mumbo Jumbo Conquered the World, A Short History of Modern Delusions. His latest book is Strange Days Indeed, a prequel of sorts to Mumbo Jumbo, and it was published by Fourth Estate this month. So we've just said there that Strange Days is a prequel to Mumbo Jumbo. Could you explain, that? Was that the intention?
I'm not sure if it was the original intention, but it swiftly turned out that way, because Mumbo Jumbo started in 1979. I mean, I didn't set out to write the Mumbo Jumbo book as a guide to the new counter-enlightenment of the last 25 or 30 years, but it just turned into that. I just wanted to write a book starting in 79, with the arrival of Margaret Thatcher and the Iranian Revolution, the Ayatollah Khomeini, the rise of market fundamentalism and religious fundamentalism, and how they had set the ideological tone for the following decades and continue to do so. And so that started in 79, which seemed to me quite a turning point in modern history. Mm-hmm. So with this one, effectively, it was several people had said to me with the Mumbo Jumbo book, so are you saying everything was tickety-boo until 79 and then everyone took leave of their senses? I said, no, certainly not. So this is in a way an answer to that. It's a look at the 1970s and how strange it was and how mad in many different senses of the word it was, and possibly some might conclude why it had to end in some form or other. I mean, why by the end of the 70s we'd reached a point. I remember when actually the day the Labour government was brought down by a no-confidence vote in March 79, I was working at the New Statesman at the time, and I was out there at the printers on the Wednesday in Southend. But the vote was that Wednesday night at 10 o'clock, and the printers couldn't wait that long. I mean, we had to make up the pages. So we had two alternative front pages, according to whether the government was toppled or not. And they were made up on plates, and one was called A and one was called B. So one said, you know, so the government lives to fight another day, and the other one said, so the government falls. And I had to go back down to London, follow the Commons vote, and as soon as they came in, I had to ring the printers and say, go with A or go with B, and the government lost. So I rang up and said, go with A, and I then sat up all night thinking, hang on, was it A or was it B, which was the right one? I scarcely slept. I was pacing the streets by about 6 a.m. trying to find some newsstand which might have an early copy. But I remember when I finally managed to get one, there was this headline blaring out saying, no confidence, this time something's got to give. And actually, the no confidence bit of the headline changed in B version, I think, but the this time something's got to give was the same in both. Whatever had happened that night, there was this sense, something's got to give. And I think this book gives you some clue as to what that something might be.
So let's look at what it is actually peculiar about the 70s and why it was like that, because right now we're in, you know, what is supposed to be the mother of all recessions, and there's constant forecasts saying how bad it is and how bad it's going to get, and yet in no way is it comparable. You know, there is not, you know, small groups of men plotting to overthrow the government and things. And why did things turn out the way they did in the 70s, do you think?
I think it was a sort of concatenation of different things, and varied from place to place, because one of the themes of this book is that there was the 70s were marked by an incredibly paranoid style, mm-hmm. You know, from Richard Nixon in America to Chairman Mao in China to Harold Wilson over here, you know, to Idi Amin in Uganda, Pol Pot and so on. I mean, there's sort of rampant political paranoia around the world. But that, of course, there were different local factors at play as well. that, for example, in post-colonial Africa, it had reached that particular stage where, you know, the post-colonial leaders were grappling with the small problem of how you replace a leader without a coup, without an overthrow. And so there was an epidemic of coups. I think only about three independent countries in Africa didn't have coups in the 1970s. And in Soviet Union and China, the post-revolutionary leaders were getting extremely old and were reaching that sort of state of insecurity when you think, blimey, what's going to happen after me? Who is going to succeed me? And you see plots and conspiracies against you everywhere and you start taking action against it and imagining all sorts of ghastly things, that sort of twilight world. And I think in Britain it was partly that the post-war consensus was beginning to fall apart, that partly in the face of economic crisis, Butskillism, as it used to be called, mm-hmm. that sort of post-war Keynesian consensus that had ruled through the 50s and 60s, somehow didn't seem to be doing the job anymore. I mean, Ted Heath's government from 1970 onwards, I think until between about 1945 and 1970, when Heath became Prime Minister, there were two states of national emergency in the previous 25 years. And Heath was Prime Minister for, what, 3.5 years or something, and declared no fewer than five just in that brief period, which gives you a slight indication of how things were going. It was just non-stop crisis and disaster, unemployment rocketing, inflation rocketing, the whole country grinding to a standstill, really, power cuts. I mean, the most memorable, I think the most abiding memory of the Heath years is power cuts and working by candlelight mm-hmm. And the three-day week, which he ended up with, and the telly going off at 10 o'clock and all the rest of it. No more floodlit football, so at least there were some compensations. But as the 70s wore on, there was increasingly a sense that Britain, in some circles, both on the left and on the right, that Britain was becoming ungovernable, that the old ruling order had given up the ghost. And there was odd agreement, actually, on left and right, that revolution was probably just around the corner. The Workers' Revolutionary Party and the International Socialists and all those sorts of people, terrifically excited. They thought, our moment is here at last. But equally, a lot of people on the right, of a conspiratorial turn of mind, said, they're probably right, we must stop it. So you had retired generals setting up private armies and business leaders trying to organise coups to bring down the government. The managing director of Cunard, the shipping line, actually went to Harold Wilson in about 1975 and said, I think I ought to warn you, Prime Minister, I've just been approached by some Secret Service people asking if I'll make the QE2 available as a floating prison for the cabinet. Actually, one of the 70s ideas that hasn't yet reappeared in the last few months, but perhaps it yet will. I mean, we seem to be heading back there at a rate of knots with economic meltdown, terrorist threats, terrorist cells in British cities. The cover of my book says Absolute Chaos Tonight, official, which is a genuine Evening Standard headline from 1973. You now see the headlines almost every other day about postal strikes, rail strikes, some imminent power cuts. The Daily Telegraph last week actually had a front-page story saying that within 2 or 3 years we're going to be getting regular power cuts because we haven't replaced enough power stations. And the headline just said, return of the 1970s looms. And I think the very next day, the football hooligans went berserk as well. So it does suddenly have a slight flickering, rather alarming sense of déjà vu about it all. But we haven't yet reached the stage of private armies and generals. Which perhaps is the difference, that perhaps because we haven't quite yet exhausted the other possibilities, but we may well reach that point.
It's also quite an auspicious time to be releasing this book, then.
It's brilliant, because I thought it was just about the most unpopular, unappealing, unfashionable subject one could think of. But then I thought that in the 1990s, when I decided to write a biography of Karl Marx, it was partly in a spirit of perversity. I thought, this is the most unpopular thing in the world in the 90s. There was this idea put about that Marx was now dead and buried and no one need ever bother with him again. I was surprised that anyone wanted to publish it, frankly, and then even more amazed when it got translated all over the world. So I thought, right, now I'll really push my luck. Write a book about the 70s. People run away screaming if you mention the 70s. And as if by magic, as I was writing it, I kept noticing all sorts of odd things happening. I mean, ever since, I think, Life on Mars went out on television about 3 years ago, it's just been one 70s revival after another. I remember end of last year, looking at the cinema, and they were showing the Baader-Meinhof complex, and the next screen had Frost Nixon on, and then I think the one next to that had Milk, the film about Harvey Milk, the 70s San Francisco gay politician. And then the alternative to all that was Mamma Mia, ABBA songs. So it is straight back to the 70s.
So you just mentioned the Baader Meinhof film, and you sort of touched on this previously, but the 70s was the time when that sort of revolutionary terrorism suddenly became fashionable as well, wasn't it? And you talk about that in the books.
Very much, yeah, urban guerrillas. The Tupamaros in Uruguay, I think, were the great pin-ups, and if you look around the world, I mean, in America, the Weather Underground and the Simeonese Liberation Army and the Angry Brigade in Britain and the Baader Meinhof and the rest of them, I mean, most of them said that they were inspired by the Tupamaros. This idea of urban guerrillas, you know, that traditionally on the left have been this idea that you have to first build a revolutionary party, and it's a rather long and tedious process, you know, creating a mass movement. And they thought, we can bypass all that, you know, six people in a basement flat, as long as they get a few guns and kidnap the odd ambassador, can work wonders and bring the whole state crashing down. And so they did. They didn't bring the state crashing down, but they did their best. And I think we got off comparatively lightly with the Angry Brigade, but on the other hand, we did simultaneously have the Provisional IRA waging a rather more serious war in cities, both in Northern Ireland and over here. The Angry Brigade, I think, must be unique among urban guerrilla groups in the 70s in that they never actually killed anyone, but I think that was more by luck than anything else.
Well, let's talk about what they did do, because everyone will obviously be familiar with the IRA, but the Angry Brigade are, you know, you almost present them as, you know, as very sort of, not particularly revolutionary, quite sort of middle class.
The slightly cross brigade, I think, would have been more accurate, yes.
So what sort of things did they actually get up to?
Well, there's an awful lot of posturing involved. I mean, they used to put out these bulletins, sort of printed with a John Bull printing set, you know, saying bulletin number 4 from the Angry Brigade. We are the person sitting next to you on the underground. We have hatred in our hearts and a bomb in our pockets. We are getting closer. It says this vast army. I mean, in fact, it's sort of about 6 or 7 people. They were a slightly farcical bunch in a way. But they created terror. The bomb squad at Scotland Yard was actually set up not in reaction to the Provisional IRA, but to the Angry Brigade. I mean, it then turned its attentions to the IRA quite soon. But it was, persuaded Scotland Yard that it was enough of a threat to have a bomb squad which actually had far more people in than the Angry Brigade itself. There was an awful lot of that posturing. I mean, the Baader Meinhof group, I mean, they were lethal and nasty, apart from anything else, anti-Semitic as well. Very odd, given that they were set up as a reaction against what they regarded as the failure of Germany to cleanse itself of the Nazi stain. And they said that the performance society in West Germany created sort of mental disorders in the population. So they then thought, I know how we'll put those mental disorders right, create even more paranoia, and go around behaving like Nazis, which they duly did. But again, with them, there's an element of posturing. I mean, I think Carlos the Jackal, who I also mentioned in the book, was a sort of emblematic figure of the period. You remember when he kidnapped the OPEC ministers at their meeting in Vienna in 1975 and took them out onto the tarmac? He spent half his time signing autographs and posing for the cameras in his leather jacket, waving a gun about, and rather like that picture of Patty Hearst taken during a bank robbery when she was turned by the Simeonese Liberation Army. I mean, there was a kind of, you know, a Che-style glamour about all that sort of thing, wearing a beret. I mean, I'm sure the generation of people, certainly when I was at school, used to have a poster of Che on the wall alongside Mick Jagger and, I don't know, who was that actress? What was she called? Raquel Welsh. And it wasn't that they were necessarily political supporters of Che, it was just he looked cool in the way that Mick Jagger looked cool in the 60s. And I think there was a lot of sort of posturing and swaggering, and it's now they've got what they deserved and what they probably wanted, in that it is now purely a fashion statement. I mean, you could go to department stores in Germany now and actually buy clothing from a range called Prada Meinhof, and you can buy the old RAF, the old Baader Meinhof T-shirts and their berets and their Ray-Ban shades at inflated prices, just so you too can look like Andreas Baader and imagine that you're a hip urban guerrilla gunslinger.
So people, I mean, obviously in Europe with Baader Meinhof and in Italy and elsewhere, it was, you know, this kind of revolutionary movement was rather more serious. But the way people, I suppose people like us talk about, you know, terrorist movements today, is that there's a definite kind of nihilism to it. But in the 70s, I mean, you know, were these groups, was there more of a specific program, was there an agenda, or was it just this kind of lashing out?
No, I think it was. It was largely nihilist. I mean, it was none of them ever... Well, there were one or two. I mean, there was specifically the Provisional IRA and the PLO and the PFLP, the Palestinian groups. I mean, they had clearly stated objectives and demands, you know, for a Palestinian state or for unification of Ireland. But apart from that, I mean, most of the others, you know, the Red Brigades in Italy or the Japanese Red Army, I mean, they were a very odd crew, the Japanese Red Army. sort of kamikaze descendants, it was entirely nihilist. I mean, there was no program, no set of demands, really. It was just, we hate you. It was, in a sense, I think, an expression of just sort of middle-class guilt and angst. And it was essentially, they were almost all essentially middle-class, as indeed were the two Pomaros. And I think it was just university graduates who were sort of a bit peeved that the 60s had fizzled out, that, you know, the great high watermark of 68 had been and gone. And some of them, some people of that generation, went off and, you know, passed their accountancy exams or whatever, or went off and lived in a commune and got their heads together, man. But some others decided that 68 had failed because they hadn't been militant and violent enough, and they had to take up arms and swagger around and let off bombs and kidnap people. And so I think that the element of nihilism is there. And also, I mean, I do think that today's terrorist movements have learned a lot from there. I mean, it was the first time, in a way, that there had been this sort of mass terrorist, not mass in the sense of numbers, but in the sense of attention, and the number of groups involved around the world, all sort of loosely linked. I mean, that's the other thing, the sort of, you know, the cell structure, but the sense that they are all in, you know, there was a lot of sort of connection between them. And I think the use of the media in particular, the sense of importance of making a spectacle. I mean, skyjackings, most notably. I mean, the 70s are punctuated by a lot of spectacular stunts and skyjackings and things like that. And you can see with things like the events of 9/11 that the modern day successors to these terrorists have learned a lot from that. Even when, you know, Osama bin Laden issues videos and things, I mean, they do understand how to use the media, how to grab attention. And I'm sure a lot of that comes from what was learned in the 70s, that even, you know, a smallish group, and obviously Al-Qaeda is a rather bigger group than, say, the Angry Brigade, can make a tremendous scare in the world and get itself onto the front pages by shrewd use of the media and images and spectaculars.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy, and we're talking to Francis Ween about his book Strange Days Indeed and the 1970s. Francis, let's talk about another one of the episodes that you talk about in the book. You've just mentioned the idea of the 70s being some sort of hangover from the 1960s. And I want to look at the Oz trial and the sort of obscenity trials that were going on around that time. There's fantastic scenes in the book of three hippies in a courtroom, totally misunderstood by the establishment. And the establishment decided that they were going to get these guys. They were made to represent a whole movement rather than the actual
I think that's true. I think it was an attempt to sort of snuff out what you might call the ludic spirit, you know, the playful spirit of and slightly anarchistic spirit of the late 60s, which Richard Neville very much embodied, the editor of Oz, the founder of Oz. I mean, he actually wrote a book called Play Power, you know, The Power of Play. Mm-hmm. A mischief and, you know, not subversion in the political sense so much as just the cultural sense. They had to be made an example of. So it was the longest obscenity trial in British history, incredibly. And it went on for 6 weeks. Went actually into the summer recess when judges are meant to go off on their holidays. It went on so long. And half of those 6 weeks, three of the 6 weeks, were given over to arguments about Rupert Bear and the size of his penis. It's incredible in retrospect, but they had a comic strip in the School Kids Oz, which caused a lot of trouble, in which the face of Rupert Bear was superimposed on a character in a Robert Crumb cartoon, the underground cartoonist. So Rupert Bear appeared to be having sex with a granny. And there were all these exchanges and cross-examinations. I think I can probably find one or two here, but expert witnesses, psychiatrists, and goodness knows who else, were grilled about the size of Rupert Bear's penis, what age he was, and all this sort of thing. Can I find it anywhere? Yes, here we are. For example, Edward de Bono, one of the defence witnesses, was asked by the prosecution counsel, "What do you suppose is the effect intended to be of equipping Rupert Bear with such a large-sized organ?" And de Bono said, "Well, I don't know enough about bears to know their exact proportions." And the barrister pressed on, "Mr. de Bono, why is Rupert Bear equipped with a large organ?" To which all de Bono could say was, "Well, what size do you think would be natural?" And so it went on week after week. And the judge had to keep saying he'll clear the public gallery if people don't stop laughing. But it's very hard not to laugh when these people who printed a cartoon of Rupert Bear are charged with, and actually this is worth reading out, what the three editors stood charged with, which could have given them unlimited prison sentences because it was a conspiracy charge. conspiring to produce a magazine containing diverse, lewd, indecent and sexually perverted articles, cartoons, drawings and illustrations, with intent thereby to debauch and corrupt the morals of children and young persons within the realm, and to arouse and implant in their minds lustful and perverted desires. And as I said, the use of a conspiracy charge actually meant that there was no limit to the sentences Judge Argyle could have imposed. And given half a chance, he would have done, because Argyle made it clear from the outset that he thought these three hairy hippies must be sent down for as long as possible. Unfortunately for him, the appeal court thought otherwise and released them afterwards, after they'd been sent for psychiatric examination, which found that they were perfectly sane, but just not entirely happy with the thought of having their hair cut and putting on a suit and a tie.
So this, I mean, this is seen, and for certainly in kind of free expression terms and more broadly, the Oz trial is seen as a key moment in, as maybe a kind of final kind of hurrah for that kind of ruling class moral authoritarianism. Mm. Can it be seen as post that, you know, that led on to the further, in some ways, that what happened in the 70s, moreover, with different things, is also part of that collapse of a kind of, you know, a ruling class?
I think it is, yes, because yeah. I think, well, in a way, the Chatterley trial had begun that. The slight difference being that the Lady Chatterley trial, just over 10 years earlier, was brought against Penguin Books, perfectly respectable publisher, and it was very noticeable there, you know, that the defendants were all chaps in suits who looked very much like the prosecution team or indeed the judge, and were probably belonged to the same kind of clubs. And it was a novel by D.H. Lawrence, who was, you know, on the English syllabus and all the rest of it. So although it was an obscenity trial in that sense was similar, I think there was a slight cultural difference about it. With the Oz trial, there was very much a sense that these were people who did not belong to the same clubs as the judge and the prosecution, and were therefore not really going to play by the rules and had to be shut up and made an example of. There was one of the many subtexts to this, which came out shortly afterwards, because people said, well, how come they're prosecuting this school kid's Oz for obscenity when there are all these far more obscene magazines on display and on sale in Soho shops, and the police never seem to prosecute them? And the Home Secretary, Reginald Maudling, asked the police about this, and the head of the Obscene Publications Squad said, oh, no, I don't think you'll find there's much in the way of pornography available in Soho, which didn't really persuade him, and they set up a little inquiry, and in due course a large number of the senior people at Scotland Yard were convicted of corruption, including the man who was behind a lot of these prosecutions, a man called George Fenwick, head of the Obscene Publications Squad. He was done, as was a man called Commander Wally Virgo. They were all on the take from the pornographers in Soho, which is why they didn't raid them but did prosecute the underground press. But the odds, I mean, the ironic consequence of it, the beneficiaries of the freeing of the Oz editors, the biggest beneficiary, I would say, was probably Rupert Murdoch, and more generally, you know, the mass media, because once it was clear that you couldn't be done for obscenity, or at least it was going to be too embarrassing for the state to bring many more obscenity prosecutions, that coincided exactly with the arrival of Rupert Murdoch at The Sun and the advent of the Page Three Girl, and suddenly there was nudity in national daily newspapers, unheard of before. And I mean, now if you look at any newsstand, you know, row after row of whatever they're called, Nuts and Heat and all, I mean, any magazine you care to take off the stands has the most astonishing amount of stuff which would have been deemed obscene until the beginning of the 70s. So it did open up this fantastic, I mean, not just in magazines, but, you know, in everything imaginable, commodification of what would once have been called obscenity. Once they got the all clear, in moved the commodifiers and the corporations to make a few bob out of it. So they I think they ought to pay a small commission probably to Richard Neville and the Oz editors for making it possible.
Just to finish off then, we often talk about conspiracy theories on the show, so it probably makes sense to talk about a conspiracy theory that did actually happen. And I'm talking about Watergate, of course, and the personage of Richard Nixon sort of hangs very heavily over this entire book. Was Nixon sort of an anomaly, or do you just think, you know, he was typical of this time? You know, he's always stood up as being, you know, a particularly paranoid American president who was particularly secretive and that. But do you think he was actually more atypical, really?
Well, he was typical of the people who were running the world at the time. And when I mentioned the book, when his famous visit to China to see Chairman Mao, they recognised each other as kindred spirits mm-hmm. straight away, both extremely paranoid people who saw enemies everywhere and plots against them everywhere. So despite the so-called political divide, actually they were soulmates and had a lot more in common than Nixon did with anyone else in the White House or outside it. But I think the importance of Watergate in particular is that, as you say, there have always been conspiracy theories, there's always been levels of political paranoia, it goes up and down, but I think until the beginning of the 70s, it was by and large political paranoia in America, say, was the preserve of fringe, people on the fringe, and usually on the right-wing fringe. And the difference is in the 70s, it suddenly became the default position for millions of fairly ordinary people, because suddenly it turned out there were conspiracies, and things that until then might have just been said by a few long-haired loons who could be dismissed as raving nutters, saying, oh, you know, the CIA is some experimenting with LSD or the FBI is spying on us all, turned out to be true, because in the wake of Watergate, there were all these Senate and congressional inquiries into the intelligence networks in America, and it found out all sorts of things about assassination plots and the whole caboodle, and suddenly all the fears that have been voiced by, say, a few people on the fringes turned out to be true. And so it then became a reasonable working assumption that not just politicians, but the corporations and other institutions, the police, the judges, whoever, were up to no good and were indeed plotting against the interests of the people in one way or another. And so it aroused this, I mean, the trust in politicians, you can measure it. The University of Michigan does surveys every 4 years, not just in politicians, but everyone, even in doctors, you know, in all sort of people regarded as officialdom, when we're in a, absolutely plummets in the 1970s, and I don't think it's ever really recovered once you lose that trust. And you can see it to this day, you know, if you watch a Michael Moore film or an Oliver Stone film or even actually the Jason Bourne trilogy, that political paranoia is still with us. I mean, it's and that's that conspiracist approach to life. And I think it does date back to Watergate and what went on with it.
But you mentioned those films, but of course that's not new, because you also talk about all of the great conspiracy theory films of the 1970s.
Oh, it's fantastic. One of the many joys of writing a book about the 70s was I could spend all my time watching The Parallax View, All the President's Men, The Conversation, The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, and pretend it was research rather than pure pleasure.
We're out of time, so Francis, thank you very much for joining us again.
Well, thank you.